Okay, we all seem to be sitting here pretty much, so let's start thinking about the next part of the lecture. What I want to talk a bit more about is filters. So I've mentioned filtering a few times, you know, in particular just in the last little section we were talking about. So what I want to do is get us a bit more up to speed on what I mean by filtering and how we can use filtering and so on. What I'm going to give you is far from being a complete description of filtering. You know, there's a whole lot of interesting work on filter design and so on that I'm not going to cover here. But we have a bunch of terminology, a bunch of techniques that I think are pretty important for you guys to understand if you're going to be signal processing guys. So there's a couple of extra references here, various books by people. Feel free to go and look them up if you're having problems with any of this stuff here. Hopefully the notes are sufficient for anything that you actually need to know for this particular course. Okay, so what is a filter? Well, a filter is a very general concept. The idea is you take some sort of signal, you put it through a filter, and the filter filters out the bit of the signal that you are interested in. What does that mean? Well, it could be anything. You could be trying to filter out the seasonality, the sort of seasonal component. You could trying to filter out the long-term trend. You could be trying to filter out harmonics. You could be trying to filter out the bits where someone is dancing in a movie. Filters are a very, very general concept, but we're going to have to deal with a fairly limited subset of filters. Filters have a bunch of different properties. And I'm going to go through these properties in a little bit more detail now, so I'm not going to go through this list. I'm going to go through each one of these things individually. How am I going to go? I'm not going to go through them in order. Let's go through... No, we will have to go through some of these. So firstly, invertibility. When we get this signal Y out the other end, it would be nice for some applications if you can invert it, if you can get the original signal back. That's not necessarily important. Sometimes it is important. Imagine you want to pick out the bits where someone is dancing in a movie. Clearly, once you pick those bits out, you can't reconstruct the whole movie anymore. But maybe it doesn't matter to you because you only cared about the bits where they're dancing. So knowing whether a filter is invertible, though, that's fairly important. Secondly, does a filter have memory, or does it just depend on the current time? So imagine that you have a filter whose job is simply to say the signal got big at this time. It's big or it's small. It just tells you that. It doesn't have to know anything about the history. Whereas on the other hand, you know, imagine the sort of silly example of trying to pick out someone dancing. From a single picture, it might be quite hard to tell if someone's dancing. Maybe they're doing athletics. Maybe they're doing gymnastics. Maybe they're just apparently standing there from that one picture. But when you look at a series of these pictures, it becomes obvious. So you need to build a filter which has some memory, takes account of the signal over some period of time. We define that simply by saying that the output at time t0 depends on x of t at some time other than t0. Then we have causality. Causality says that the filtered output only depends on the history of the process. Doesn't depend on the future. Imagine you have something which is happening now, which depends on something that's going to happen in the future. That's not causal. That's violating causality. We can do that in a filter, because you can design your filter to delay the output until the future has already happened. So imagine you put your signal into the filter, you wait till the entire signal has gone into the filter, and then you output something. So the filter itself is not acausal. The output still comes out after all the inputs it needs. But the value at some time t0 doesn't, you know, if it's causal, it only depends on what happens before that time. Causal filters are very appealing for a lot of applications because then you can do them in real time. There's no delay. You don't have to wait for something to happen before you can produce an output, because it only depends on the history and the state of the process at time t. So causal filters are very useful. We also quite often want to have a stable filter. What do I mean by stable? There's all sorts of definitions. The typical definition that we're going to apply here is what we call bounded input, bounded output. BIBO. Okay, what does that mean? Well, if the input is bounded, it means that the absolute value of our input signal is less than some constant. N could be whatever we like, but it's constant. Doesn't change over time. This just means that this is a bound on our signal. So if our signal is bounded, that is, you know, the energy in our input signal is finite, then we would expect the energy of the output signal to be finite as well. So we would like it then if our output signal is also bounded. This is just another number R. I'm not telling you what it is, I'm just telling you it exists. Does it ever happen that you get filters which aren't bounded input, bounded output? Yes. It definitely can happen. You can design a filter which tends to amplify a signal. And if you set that up the right way, you get a feedback loop and it just amplifies it off to infinity. That's not too great. So we're going to try and stay in the realm of stable filters. Time invariance means that if we shift time, we change time, we move this way or this way, the filter doesn't see that. What this means is our filter doesn't change over time. So the way of defining that is you say, you know, x gives us y is the same as x at t minus t naught giving us y at t minus t naught. But the important thing to understand is that the filter doesn't change over time. It's what time invariance means. And then linearity. I have a little slide on linearity. We talked about linearity before. The idea of a linear operator is an operator where when you apply the operator to a linear combination of two input signals, you get a linear combination of the output signals. So a linear filter is just a linear operator. Takes our signals, say x1 turns it to y1, x2 turns to y2, so the linear combination of the two gives us a linear combination of the two outputs. Linearity is an interesting property. There is a very large class of filters which are linear filters. They are a very useful class of filters. They do a lot of things. They often talked about in it, for instance, a course like this, because they're also mathematically tractable. They're easy to deal with in math. Not all filters are linear though. And you have to be aware of this. You can do some really clever things with nonlinear filters. It's outside of the scope of this course, but nonlinear filters can be used to good effect. The trouble with nonlinear filters is they're much harder to do the mathematical analysis of, and they can do some weird things. So we'll stick with linear filters here, but I want you to understand that linearity is a limiting assumption. It does limit what we can do with our filters. Now, if we have linear filters like this, then what we can do is we can think of, well, I could take my input signal to be an impulse. I could take it to be a delta. And I could take this guy to be another delta. So if I took all of those, that possible set of deltas, then I can see that the output would be a linear combination of that set of deltas. That's what this says here. The output is a linear combination of a series of deltas at each time point. So if I take any input signal, I can write it in this form. And this is just a set of numbers that give me that linear combination. So for any linear filter, I can write it in this form. Likewise, if I can write it in this form, it's a linear filter. Pretty obvious, pretty easy to prove that. Okay, time invariant filters. Well, remember, time invariant filters can't change over time. In terms of these coefficients, what that means is WMI has to be WI. Why is that? Well, have a look at this guy. Think about what would happen if I shifted this and I put an extra, say, minus K in here and a minus K in here. Well, be the same as putting a minus k here. I want that to be the same, So all of these guys have to be the same. So when I shift this M, when I change this M, it has to be constant. So we get this sort of form here. WMI has to equal WI. Time invariance is also a limitation on filters, but it's typically one that's not such a big problem because, you know, you don't want to matter, you know, you're going to have a signal that's going to come in to some filter. Now imagine that for some reason your signal got delayed a little bit. Imagine, you know, just for the sake of argument, you were taking your signal, you had a tape recording or something, and you wanted to use that as your input signal. Imagine you just got delayed by a second when you were pressing the play button. You wouldn't want the output to be, you know, fundamentally different. The output signal might be delayed by a second, but you don't want it to fundamentally change. So this time invariance property is something we generally assume. Obviously, we can then write our filter equation like this. Now, I hope by now you have taken my comments about convolutions to heart, and you realize that understanding convolutions is important for this course, and you look at this and you say, aha! Who said aha when they saw this? Who thought aha? Okay. None of you thought, this is just a convolution. This is just a convolution. And this is a general thing. A linear time invariant filter can be written as a convolution. And this is one of the reasons why linear time invariant filters are the things we study so much, because we can write them as a convolution. So a useful thing to be able to do. So let me talk a little bit more about convolution. This is just my definition of a convolution here. Remember, we've seen this before. One of the reasons convolution is interesting, one of the reasons we can do things with it, is because when we take the Fourier transform of a convolution, we get a product. This is just the convolution theorem, we call it. What does this mean? Well, it makes it darn easy to work out what this guy is going to look like, because we just take a Fourier transform of our signal, a Fourier transform of these coefficients, these W's, and take the product of them, and that will give us a Fourier transform of our signal, do an inverse Fourier transform, and we get the output signal. So it gives us a really good way of working out what's going to happen with a particular filter. We run into one problem here though. You notice these infinities, these guys. How many signals really go out to infinity? I require an answer to this. How many signals really go out to infinity? None. Not a single one. All of the signals we'll ever deal with stop at some point, start at some point. Why is that? Well, at the very least, the universe started at some time point. The signal can't have started before the universe. Likewise, the universe is going to wind down at some point. So we can't take our integrals out to infinity. This is always an approximation, this infinite sum. So there are various ways of making this approximation. There are a couple of different things that people often do. One is zero padding. So, you know, remember we talked about padding. The idea is you just put some zeros into your function. So if I take my finite signal and I pretend it's infinite, but all of the values out to infinity are zero, then I can do my infinite sum. And you notice that a lot of the things, a lot of the elements in this convolution, they're just going to be zero times zero. 0 times 0, I don't have to do. I know what the answer is. It's not too hard to work out what 0 times 0 is. So I just ignore it. So effectively what this amounts to is assuming that I have an infinite signal but it's being truncated. And then I can truncate these sums. Another way of doing it though is to truncate this summation and assume that I only need to calculate over some range. And there I would truncate away any bits that might be polluted by the edges, by the bits where this sort of truncation of the signal has some sort of impact. So there are a couple of different things I can do to get around these infinities. Another thing I can do is what we call a circular convolution. So let me tell you what a circular convolution is. This is a circular convolution written out here. And you notice instead of having a sum from minus infinity to infinity, I have a sum from 0 to n minus 1. Anyone want to guess how long my signal is? My signal is length n. Okay? My signal is length n, and x is length n, and y is also length n in this particular way of writing it down. So what does my convolution look like? Well, it looks exactly like an ordinary convolution, but see if I can reach. Imagine that bit's not there. Imagine the bit that says mod n isn't there. That just looks like an ordinary convolution. It looks like this thing. But what I've done is put a mod n here. So we get a sum over these two guys. I could go and explain modulus arithmetic to you all. Some of you probably know it better than I do, and some of you probably never seen it before, so I'm not going to try and do that. What I want to do is try and explain why we call it a circular convolution. So what we do is we imagine writing our values. These are the values of x. They're written around this outside circle. The values of y are written around the inside circle, but you notice that they're written in the opposite order. So I go y0, y1. They're written anti-clockwise. These guys are written clockwise. So, imagine that I want to take a value of n equals 0 in here. So I'm taking my convolution x star y at the value 0. What I do is I take x0, multiply it by y0, and add to that x1 times y7, x2 times y6, x3 times y5, and so on around the circle. So that gives me my convolution at the 0 point. When I want to take the convolution for n equals 1, what I do, see this arrow? I'm just going to rotate this inner circle around 1. So now y0 is here, and so on. So now to take this convolution here, I take x0 times y1, x1 times y0, x2 times y7, x3, and so on around the circle, and add all of those guys up. So this is how you do a circular convolution. And you can see you just rotate this guy around until you get to the end. y7. You notice that I only have 8 elements around here, so my convolution will only have 8 elements. So this is the last one. So that's a circular convolution. And what I have here for you is a little example. I'm not going to go through these examples in any great detail. What I have is a little example just to give you some practice if this is still all seeming a bit vague. So I have two signals up here. I'm going to convolve x with itself. This is the circular convolution. I expect you should go away and check that if you don't already know why it looks like 1210. And now what I've gone and done is write out that convolution in full, just so that you get an example of it. The other thing that I've done is take some Fourier transforms just to prove to you that the Fourier transform of a circular convolution also gives us a product. This is not a proof, this is just an example. The proof is very similar to the proofs we've already seen, that the Fourier transform of a convolution gives us a product. But this just gives you an example of the convolution theorem for circular convolutions. Same thing holds. So the point I'm trying to make, we can do convolutions in a bunch of different ways. We can do continuous ones, we can do discrete ones, we can do circular convolutions. And when we have a finite series, we have to think a little bit about which one we're doing. When we have a finite series and we do a filter on it, are we going to do a circular convolution? Are we going to do a discrete convolution? The implication of a circular convolution is that all the signals that you're looking at are periodic. So what's happening here is you assume that the signal and the filter that you're using are going to be periodic. And so as you go around the circle, you're really just adding up the periodic components. Remember when we do a discrete Fourier transform on a finite signal, there's an implication. There's a sort of implicit periodicity in that signal. There's an assumption when you do that discrete Fourier transform that we're taking an infinite sum over a series of periodic repetitions of that signal. Okay. Causality, well, causal filters just have all of these terms w of minus I equals 0. that the filter terms going off to in the positive time, the future, they're zero. They don't have any impact on the filter. So you end up with a filter that looks like this. You notice that the lower end goes from I equals zero to infinity instead of I equals minus infinity to infinity. Okay. So I've told you a bunch of stuff about filters, but the first thing that we want to do with a filter is characterize it. We want to describe it. Now, there are a whole bunch of ways I could describe a filter. When I've given you my description, though, I want it to do two things. I want it to be complete. I want it to tell you everything you have to know about that filter. There's no point in me telling you, I'm going to build a filter to detect dancing, because I haven't told you what dancing is. You really could have an argument about what dancing is. Particularly if you watch me dancing, you'd probably say that wasn't dancing. So, what does this mean? Well, we need to have a way that describes the filter completely. We don't want to have any redundancy in our description, though. I mean, I could tell you a lot about my filter. I could spend the next month telling you about my filter. You'd probably get pretty bored. So we want to have a nice description which tells us everything we need to know, but doesn't leave anything out and doesn't waste any time, doesn't waste any space. The standard way of doing this is called the impulse response of the filter. So we take a filter like this and we put an impulse in it, a delta. We send a delta through the filter and we observe some response. This is called the impulse response. And this provides us with a complete characterization of our filter. Why is that? Well, let's work it out. I'm going to take my input signal to my filter. This, remember, this is my equation for the filter. It's just a convolution. This is my input signal. It's just a delta function, in this case, a Kronecker delta, because we're dealing with discrete time. And this is my impulse response. And you can see that the impulse response, when I take this sum, this goes zero except when m is equal to I. So all of these terms are going to be zero except the Wm term, which is just going to give me Wm. So this is the impulse response. So these W's that I started out, I just told you there were some numbers. Those numbers are actually the impulse response of the filter. And when we take a filter, what we get is a convolution of the impulse response, this guy, with the input signal. Okay. Now what I've written here is just going back the other way. Given this impulse response, I know that I can write any filter, any signal as a linear combination of these impulses. So this is a linear combination of a series of impulses. These are the impulses. These are the linear combination factors. This is my signal. This is an obvious representation of my signal. I'm just going to put this input signal into the filtering equation, the convolution, and it just ends up with an equation that looks like my convolution, the one I started with. It's kind of obvious. This is like almost too obvious to write down. All I'm saying here is that the linearity of the filter works with us here. Obviously, this characterization, this impulse characterization, this depends on having this linear time invariant filter, because if it's not linear time invariant, the impulse response doesn't tell me as much. Because if I put two impulses in, I don't just get a linear combination of the output, I get some weird superposition, non-linear combination. So I can get some very weird things happening there. Okay. Now, let's think about processes or filters which have memory. We can have two different sorts of memory. The two typical classifications are what we call finite impulse response and infinite impulse response. Finite impulse response means the impulse response is finite. Okay, that doesn't mean the values are finite. What it means is the extent is finite, or the support of the impulse response is finite. The support is the set where the values are non-zero. So when the support is finite, it means that there's some value of n such that W of n is equal to zero whenever we have a little n greater than big N. Outside of this region, the support, the values are all zero. Finite support means this region has finite size. It's a region where the values are non-zero. Infinite impulse response is just the other thing. If the values never go down to zero, or if they never, you know, not all of them go down to zero, there's an infinite number of them, then we have infinite support, and we have an infinite impulse response filter. So you might say, okay, you just told me signals were finite. Filters must be finite as well, mustn't they? So how can I write, I mean, this isn't sensible, is it? I just told you they must all look like that. How can I possibly ever have a filter that looks like this? Anyone want to make a guess? Okay, we'll talk about it in a minute. So here's a simple filter, it's a moving average. It's finite. I mean, you could have a moving average filter where these guys go out to infinity. But most of the time when people talk about a moving average, they mean a finite moving average. And you notice that the way I've written the moving average, I've got these coefficients bi in here. This is just the w's. I mean, I just changed the letter. I'm using b instead of w. I'm doing that for a particular reason. I'm trying to meet up with some notation that comes in from stats and some other areas. But the using b instead of w, that's trivial. Doesn't matter. Why is it called a moving average? Well, quite often you write a moving average, this would be a typical one people would use. So this is an average of the values where in a window. Imagine you have your data point, say time point N or I. We look at a window around that time point and we average the signal over that time window. That's what this guy is doing. It's a conventional idea of an average. So this moving average here is a generalization of this guy. Often when people say moving average, they mean this. So this is one of those things. Different areas use moving average, they use the terminology moving average differently. In engineering, moving average probably means this thing more often. In stats, maybe it means this thing. But if you look at financial time series, moving average probably always means this thing. If you look at some other areas where people do time series analysis, they often mean this thing. I'm going to try and be precise. I'm going to call this a symmetric rectangular window moving average because it's a rectangular window. We'll talk about windows in lecture 7, I think. And it's symmetric, so it's symmetric around I. You notice we go from minus n to n. And it's just a simple moving average because we're taking average over these values. But this is a more general formulation of a moving average. You notice this is a non-causal filter because it depends on both the future and the past of the function. You know, we're depending on, this is yn, depends on values of the function, the input signal in the future and in the past. But you can do a moving average which is causal. I could get rid of that future part and do a moving average. Then it would no longer be symmetric. So this is one of the issues in filter design is, you know, there are always going to be conflicts. You're going to want to have a filter which is symmetric, but you want to have a filter which is causal. You can't have both. Here is another example of a filter. This is a difference operator. You notice that this is a special case of a moving average. But typically people don't call this a moving average. It's called a difference. Why is that? Well, it's a special case. Also, it does something different. You know, people in financial time series, when they mean a moving average, they mean something that averages. An average you can think of as a smoother. It smooths the signal. This thing does anything but smooth the signal. In fact, what it tends to do is pull out edges. You can see that if these two values are close together, you're going to get a small value here. But if these have a big difference, you get a big value here. So what it does is it tends to highlight places where there are differences in the signal. Those tend to be edges. Think of an image. You see an edge in an image, there's a big difference in the two values on either side of the edge. Notice this is a causal filter because yn only depends on the past of the input signal. Here's another one. This is a good one. This is called an exponentially weighted moving average. It is a moving average, but not quite. It's not a moving average in the sense of the one that I showed you earlier. Why is that? Well, you notice on the right hand side I have a Y. Am I allowed to do that? Of course I'm allowed to do it. I'm telling you what I'm allowed to do. The problem with putting a Y over here though is that this is no longer, this YN is no longer just a function of the input. It's also a function of the output. This is what we call feedback. We're taking our signal, our output signal, and we're feeding it back into the filter. Perfectly allowable, but it does cause a bit of difference. Now I'm going to show you in a little while how we derive this, but I can rewrite this equation like this. So I can take this equation where I've got a very simple form of it. I'm just taking my signal, output signal, 1 minus A times Xn plus A times Yn minus 1, and I can write it like this. Now, look at this guy. It says infinity there. This is why we get infinite impulse response filters. When we have feedback, we can get a response which depends on the whole history. We're feeding back the output into the signal. As we do that, we bring in the history. And as we keep doing that, we never lose that history. It keeps being fed back into the system. So the history, the memory of the process, goes back forever. You notice it geometrically decays. That's a good thing. Otherwise, talk about that in a minute. But there are an infinite number of filter coefficients here. Even though the filter itself, this is a practical filter, I can build that filter. The net result is an infinite impulse response, even though the filter itself is finite. It's very important that you understand how we get between these, and I'll talk about that a bit more a bit later on in the lecture. Typically, we can generalize this form of filter. We can write something like this, where we have a number of feedback terms. And I'm going to have an A here for those guys, coefficient for these. So we have a number of these terms. We call this an autoregressive process, autoregressive filter. Autoregressive comes from the stats community, where people talk about autoregressive time series being a signal. So you can have a signal which has this sort of property, but actually what we mean is the signal is an output of a process or a filter which looks like this. So this is an interesting sort of thing to get straight. Signal processing people and stats people, a lot of the time they're actually doing essentially the same thing. Time series analysis and signal processing have a huge amount in common. And a lot of the terminology, things like autoregressive, are in common. But some of the notation and some of the way people talk about these things is a bit different in subtle ways. Time series analysis person will talk about something like this as a time series, whereas we're going to talk about it as the output of a filter. Okay. LTI just stands for linear time invariant filter. So LTI filters are the things we're going to study here. We know that this convolution theorem can help us here. So let's take the impulse response and let's do a Fourier transform of it. The nice thing about that is that the Fourier transform, we don't lose any information in the Fourier transform. Take the Fourier transform of the impulse response. We haven't lost anything. We haven't added redundancy or anything. So that's also going to be a complete characterization of the filter. The Fourier transform of the impulse response tells us everything we need to know about the filter. And one of the really nice things about that transform is it tells it to us in a way which is much easier, at least for me, to understand. If I look at an impulse response of the filter, I sort of go, I can tell if that's causal, and I can tell if it's linear, and I can tell if it's got a memory, and I can tell those things. But I can't really tell what it does, except for some simple example. I can't say, oh, that filter's just going to do X. But if you look at it in the frequency domain, everything is much easier. Remember, convolution is kind of a hard thing to do. Multiplication is easy. So we're going to give this transform a special name. The transform of the impulse response, this guy, is called the transfer function. And I'm going to write it like this. The DFT of my impulse response is going to be big W of K. It's going to be my transfer function. And what it tells us is what's going to happen to the spectrum of the output signal. So what it can tell us is these sort of things. I've talked about these sort of ideas a little bit as we went through the course. Now I'm going to be a bit more precise. The low-pass filter, what it does is it passes low frequencies. So when I look at the transfer function, I'm going to see that for low frequencies it's 1, and for high frequencies it's close to 0. So when I multiply my signals transformed by that sort of filter, the low frequencies won't be affected, the high frequencies will be removed, attenuated just means reduced. The high frequencies will be attenuated, and I'll be left with the low frequency component of that signal. So low pass filter, that's what it does. A high pass filter passes the high frequencies. Band pass filter passes a band of frequencies. And a notch filter, so the idea of a notch filter is the opposite of a band pass filter. What it does is it attenuates a band. A band pass passes a band and attenuates everything else. A notch filter passes everything except the notch, and it attenuates that notch. So let me give you some examples. This is my simple moving average filter up here. This is a low pass filter. I know this because I can take the Fourier transform. This red line here is the Fourier transform of my impulse response. The impulse response of this guy is easy. It's just a series of ones. So the impulse response is pretty easy. I can take the Fourier transform. Actually, the impulse response is good. I mean, it's a good example here. The impulse response is going to look like this. It's pretty simple. Imagine that just being approximation of a rectangular pulse. What's the Fourier transform of a rectangular pulse? Sinc function. The Fourier transform of a rectangular pulse is a sinc. So if I take my rectangle, that will go to be a sinc. That's what this red curve is. Actually, this red is a sinc squared because I'm looking at power. So it's pretty easy to work out what the Fourier transform is going to be here. So let's have a think about what this red curve is. This red curve, it's big up here near low frequencies, and down here it gets smaller. Notice this is a log scale, so that's actually a fair bit smaller. So this is my filter. It passes the low frequencies and it attenuates these higher frequencies. So what I've done here, this blue curve is a signal. It's actually a short segment of a longer signal. And that signal is white noise. I'll tell you more about white noise theoretically later on, but the point of white noise is its spectrum is flat. So you can see its spectrum here, and with some variations around it, you see a flat spectrum. When I pass this signal through my moving average up here, you can see what happened to it. It got attenuated by my filter, my red terms here, the filter, and the signal spectrum got attenuated so that it sort of lies below that signal now. And this is the output here. So what happened? Well, I smoothed the signal. Notice this goes from minus 5 to 5. It's jumping up and down and so on. Here I have a signal which goes zzzz. It's much smoother, much simpler. It smoothed it out. This is what low pass filters do. They smooth their averages. So this is just the same thing with a different input signal where I took 10 signs, added them together, put them through my low pass. You can see these higher frequencies are attenuated and the output signal's over here. Differencer. What does a differencer do? Well, this again, this red curve is the transfer function. It's the Fourier transform of the impulse response. The impulse response in this case is 1 minus 1. So it's a Fourier transform of a signal which looks like 1 minus 1. And in fact, to get it over this range, I've padded that out. So actually, I'm looking at 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, minus 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, a longer signal. And lo and behold, what does this do? Well, what a differencer does is it passes the high frequencies, attenuates these low frequencies. So it's a high pass filter. That's what I've said down here. And again, I've applied it to this input of sine waves. What about my exponentially weighted moving average here? Well, this is an infinite impulse response filter, so it's not quite so obvious what it's going to do. But when we look at the transfer function, it is obvious. What sort of filter is this? What sort of filter is this? It's a low pass filter. These lower frequencies are being attenuated. I mean, there is some attenuation here, but these guys are being attenuated a lot more. When we talk about low pass and high pass, it's not ever an exact thing. Okay, I'll give you a little slide about what we mean in a second, but there's always some transition region. There's a boundary where the signal isn't completely attenuated. But you can see that this is a low pass, so we would expect it to smooth the signal, and lo and behold, we look at the output signal and it has been smoothed. Big surprise there. And again, this is the same thing being applied to a sine wave. Yeah, the smoothed version of this looks a bit weird, but it is smooth. So how might you apply these sort of filters? Well, this is a little example. This is data from, I think it's Yahoo's finance. Yahoo provide you with stock quotes. And this is financial data. I think this is the All Ordinaries. Just trying to remember. This is the All Ordinaries from Australia from... Oh, it's got some dates on it. From, where are we down here? This is, this is over a couple of months. And I think this data is from, it's from 2004. It's got it written up here. So the blue curve is showing the actual data. And then the green and the red curves are showing you a 30-day and a 10-day moving average, and the EMA here is an exponentially weighted moving average. Why am I bothering to show you this? Well, Yahoo does those curves for you. Those that moving average and that exponentially weighted moving average, these are things that people actually use in the finance industry. And most of the people who use them don't know what it means. Most of the guys who look at these stock quotes, I would say 99.9% of them know less about a moving average than you know now. They don't know what it does. They don't know what it means. That's kind of scary to me. These guys who are making big financial decisions don't really know what these things do. They have some intuition about what it means in terms of predicting the stock values. Let's have a little think about what's going on here as well. These are stock quotes. So, you know, you notice this curve comes, the red and the green curve come all the way to this blue data point. These stock quotes, imagine I'm trying to guess what the price is going to be tomorrow. I want to do some sort of prediction. I want to guess what it's going to be. Can I use the value of the stock price tomorrow? No. If I could do that, I wouldn't need to predict. If I could look up the stock price tomorrow, I would be a very rich man today. I could just use it. So when we're doing these sort of filters, we have to use causal filters. These financial filters, it's a moving average, but it's not this symmetric moving average I showed you. It's just the 10-day moving average of the past 10 days. The exponentially weighted moving average is a causal filter, so we don't have to worry about that. But you notice something here. The filter values lag behind the blue curve. So the blue curve goes up, and it takes a while for the green and red curve to catch up. Blue curve goes up, they go up a bit more slowly. Blue curve goes down, a bit afterwards these guys come down. They lag. Remember, this is a time shift which corresponds to a phase shift in the frequency domain. So having an asymmetric filter ends up with a phase shift in the frequency domain. I'm not going to spend much time talking about phase shifts, but these sort of phase shifts are important as well when you're designing filters. What else am I going to say about this? Well, what does this blue and this green and red curve tell you? Well, the idea is to remove some of the noise in the data. There's a sort of belief that this sequence corresponds to some underlying signal, some signal which is, you know, is it a good year or is it a bad year? The stock will go up in a good year. But there's noise on top of that. And so what we're trying to do is remove the noise from the signal by doing these moving averages. This is what people hope to achieve. So they can see the underlying signal, and they can see here, oh look, that was a big increasing trend, wasn't it? Okay, so why did you choose 10 days in this particular picture? Why did I choose 10 days? Could have chosen a much longer period. In fact, this is a much longer series of data. And what I have here is some moving averages. I have the 10-day exponential weighted moving average, and I have the 200-day, 200-day moving average and exponentially weighted moving average. By the way, no one's asked what I mean by 10-day exponentially weighted moving average. I'm not going to tell you because you didn't ask. You'll have to work it out yourself. Okay, you can see very clearly the lags here. You can see that the pink curve, which is this 10-day moving average, actually goes very close, apparently, to the blue curve. You can hardly see the difference. Whereas the green and the red curve, these 200-day averages, lag quite a long way behind. But they smooth a lot more. The longer this filter, the more smoothing you get, but the more lag you get there. So what this sort of introduces, I guess, is the idea that when you're designing filters, when you're choosing what sort of filter you want to have, you're going to have some sort of goal, because there are going to be trade-offs here. There are going to be lags, there are going to be various issues that you're going to have to deal with. Anyway, this is a little practical example. When we start designing filters, and again, I got to reiterate, this is not really a course on filter design, so I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time on it. What we want to do is design a filter with good properties. So let me tell you about some of the properties of a filter first. This picture is just terminology, really. So this would be a low-pass filter because, you know, the transfer function up here. So this blue curve shows you a transfer function. And we can see that the transfer function up here is big, so that's the pass band. So I'm going to call this region here the pass band, the band that's being passed. But you notice that the transfer function is not constant over this. Typically, it's quite hard to get a transfer function which is exactly flat. You saw that in the examples I showed you, they weren't exactly flat. There's often a little bit of ripple here. So we call this the passband ripple, and we give some sort of width to that. We say how big that is. Also, it's hard to have a filter which drops instantly from passing to attenuating. There's typically a transition region, which we call this thing. Then we have the stop band, which is all of this region where we're seeing attenuation. And the stop band attenuation is how much we decrease the signal in the attenuated region. And you also get some ripple here. We typically call these things side lobes because it's a little lobe of power that's off of this main lobe. And typically with filters, you see they have side lobes, they have some sort of transition region and so on. Okay. So what we want to do when we design a filter is typically we want the passband ripple to be small. We want the stopband attenuation to be big. We want this guy to be almost zero. We want the transition region to be really small, and so on and so forth. We want this to look like a rectangle, basically. We want this to be a rectangle, sharp edge, and flat down here. Okay, so this is in the Fourier domain. I could just say, let's have a rectangle in the Fourier domain. Great. Easy. What happens when I transfer that back? So I take my transfer function and I transform it back into the time domain. What's the Fourier transform of a rectangle? You've already heard it once today. It's a sinc function. So if I take my perfect filter in the frequency domain and transform it back to the time domain, I end up with a sync function. It's an infinite impulse response filter with a sync function as its Fourier transform. So it's not causal. It's acausal. It has infinite impulse response. It doesn't decay very quickly. So I need a lot of terms to approximate that filter in the time domain. So if I build this filter in the time domain, this attempt to make a perfect filter, I end up with a filter that has a lot of coefficients. You think about implementing a filter like this. Every time I do a multiply, that's going to cost me some compute power. If I have an infinite impulse response filter, or a filter with a very large number of terms, that means a lot of multipliers. If I want to implement that on my DSP chip, I'm going to have to buy a big, expensive DSP chip. But no, I would rather buy a nice little cheap DSP chip. So I want to do operations which have relatively few multipliers. Okay, another way I could go about doing this. I could, instead of doing a filter the way I've shown you so far, we're doing filters as convolutions. Instead of doing that, I could do my filter in the time domain. I've already explained to you how to do that. We take the Fourier transform, we multiply by the transfer function, and then we do the inverse Fourier transform. So that's pretty easy. Except that the Fourier transform, even the fast Fourier transform, takes order n log n computations. So as the length of my series increases, the number of computations increases superlinearly. What does that mean? Well, that means it's impractical for me to do that sort of filtering for very long signals. Okay, what do I mean very long? Well, that depends on the DSP chips you've got at your disposal. So we end up with a bunch of trade-offs here. We can't really do this perfect filter, but we want to improve the stop-band attenuation, we want to improve things like that. The filters I've shown you so far are pretty crap. It's interesting, those are the filters that get used a lot in the stats community, they get used a lot in the time series community, they get used a lot in financial community, but they're crap filters. The stop band attenuation is crap, it's 26 dB. That's 26 dB of power. We can get filters which are much better than that. The pass band, you know, the transition region for this green guy is the entire pass band almost. You know, you could say, is that the pass band or is that the transition region? Can't even really say. The transition regions are big. The side lobes are big. These are not great filters. You can do much, much better with a little bit of careful filter design. As I said, we could do filtering in the frequency domain. It takes order n log n operations. That's not great for us. The other thing about doing a perfect filter. So imagine I do a filter where the blue curve is my signal, and I do a filter which looks like this. Perfect filter in the frequency domain. Those ripples, we call them Gibbs phenomena, those little passband ripples, we call them Gibbs phenomena. And if we do a perfect filter in the time domain, in the frequency domain, those Gibbs phenomena end up being in the time domain. So you get these, instead of filtering the signal such that you get this nice smooth version of it, you get these little ripples, potentially. Those little ripples can be really obvious in some sorts of signals. For instance, images, those little ripples can appear. They can be quite visually obvious. So this perfect filter, it's not even necessarily something that we want to get. We want some sort of compromise. We want to design a filter which has not too many multipliers in it, but which does some sort of good attenuation and so on. Am I going to tell you how to design it? I'm not going to tell you everything about it. I'm going to tell you the starting point, how we would start to think about designing one of these sort of filters. And the reason I'm going to tell you about that is because it introduces a new transform called the Z-transform, which I think is pretty valuable that you guys know about. One bit of notation, TAPS. I'll talk about TAPS in a little while. TAPS is really the number of multipliers we have to do in our filter. So let's talk about Z-transforms quickly. We're going to take a transform of our, this is our impulse response, remember, and I'm going to transform it by taking a sum over all of the impulse response terms times z to the minus n, and that will give me a transform at a position z. But z could be any complex number. Okay, z is a complex number now. It's not just 1, 2, 3 or half or something. So this actually looks like something that I've dealt with a lot more. I deal with what we call probability generating functions from time to time. They're very useful in the context of probability, stochastic modeling. But you notice the only difference here is that we have a z to the positive power of n, here it's z to the minus power of n. So it's essentially these are the same transform. But they're given different names and the sign is different. I don't quite know. I think it's a historical thing. They were both independently used by two different communities. So, let's think about what this Z transform does. What would happen if I put e to the I 2 pi k in here as Z? Well, what I would get when I wrote that down would be the discrete Fourier transform. So when I take W, my Z transform, at these points, I get a Fourier transform. What are these points? They're points that are evenly spaced around the unit circle in the complex plane. Gotta know that. We just take a circle, the unit circle in the complex plane, and we take a series of sample points around that. So, this is my Fourier transform. This is a signal, discrete signal, you'll see. This is my power spectrum. This is my discrete Fourier transform, that's the magnitude of it, obviously squared, to get the power. And this is what it looks like in the Z transform domain. What I've done is I've taken this guy and I've wrapped it around this circle here. This is the unit circle in the complex plane. This is the real axis, this is the imaginary axis here, and this is just the value of the signal, the power. So this is what my Fourier transform looks like here. Now, the thing about the Z transform is it extends this Fourier transform to that whole plane. So when I calculate the Z transform, I can calculate that whole plane, and the Fourier transform is just a special case of it. I have a picture of that somewhere. Ah, here's a picture. So this is a picture of a Z transform, where we look at the whole complex plane. And you can see it looks like a bit like a sheet that's been stretched across that plane somehow. The convolution theorem applies to Z transforms, so if I take the Z transform of a convolution, I get that to a product. I'll leave the proof as an exercise for the student. You can see it's the same as the Fourier transform, the convolution theorem. The inverse Z transform though is a lot more difficult than the Fourier transform because we have to do a contour integral in the complex plane, and given that you guys, some of you at least probably forgotten your complex integration, I'm not going to try and deal with this at all. There is another way of doing the inverse, and the other way of doing the inverse I will show you, but you can only do that in special cases. So don't worry too much about this, but it's worthwhile knowing that you can invert it. It's just not quite as simple to do as the Fourier transform. So let me introduce a new sort of filter. We're going to call it an ARMA filter, which stands for autoregressive moving average. So it's autoregressive because it has this autoregressive term in it, and it's a moving average because it has a moving average term over here. So I'm going to rewrite it. I'm going to chuck these terms over this side. And then I'm going to take a Z transform. You notice this is a convolution and this is a convolution. So when I take the Z transform of a convolution, I get a product. And that's what I get down here. Y of Z is the Z transform of Y. A of Z is the Z transform of A. And so on for B and X. So you can see that my ARMA filter, I can write in this simple form here. Just rearrange that. I write Y of Z equals B of Z on A of Z equals X of Z. So this complicated, ugly ARMA filter that's kind of scary when you first see it, in the transform domain, it's really, really simple. Now, you notice that because this is a finite sum, A of Z is just the polynomial of degree P in Z. Likewise, B is a polynomial of degree Q in Z. Polynomials have zeros. The zeros of a polynomial are just the values where they're equal to zero. We can work out where those zeros are. They're in the complex plane. So we know the zeros of a polynomial. We can work out where they are in the complex plane. And those zeros have an effect on our transform. So think about it. This guy here, B of Z on A of Z, this is the transfer function. So a transfer function of the, you know, in the Z domain, not in the frequency domain, it's a transfer function. B of Z zeros, they're going to be places where the transfer function is zero. A of Z zeros, wherever A of Z is zero, that's going to be an asymptote. It's going to be a point which goes up to infinity. So we call these poles and zeros. We call the zeros of A of Z poles, we call the zeros of B of Z zeros. Big deal there. Why do we call them that? Well, imagine that the transfer function is a rubber sheet. It's a sort of rubber sheet analogy here. Then the zeros, notice the log scale here, the zeros kind of push down on the rubber sheet. They're like, you took your finger and you pressed down on it here. The poles are like you pushed up on the rubber sheet. So imagine a pole, you know, like a flagpole. Imagine a flagpole here pushing up on the rubber sheet. Now, this is clearly an approximation, this picture I've drawn here. Why is that? Well, you know that this is actually an asymptote. This is going to go into infinity. So what I've just drawn is the values up to a certain value, because I don't want to try and draw infinity because then it will look stupid. Likewise here, this is going down to zero, but look, it's a log scale. If I take log of zero, I'm going to get, you know, an asymptote again. And so this is going down to minus infinity. So this picture is an approximation. Okay, so a lot of filter design techniques are just about choosing where the poles and zeros of these filters go. And there are a bunch of these different techniques. I'm not going to spend much time telling you about them, except for instance to say that causal linear time invariant filters, if we want these to be stable, all of the poles have to be inside the unit circle on the complex plane. So let's have a look at the exponentially weighted moving average, just as a little example. I can work out the A and Z. They're pretty obvious. You just need to do the transfer. You need to do the Z transform of the A coefficients and the B coefficients over here. We get two functions like this. B of Z divided by A of Z looks like this. So I'm going to multiply the top and the bottom by Z, and I get a function that looks like this. 1 minus A times Z divided by Z minus A. Clearly, single zero of the function is when Z is equal to zero. That's when this top bit is zero. The bottom bit is zero when Z is equal to A. So for the filter bit to be stable, mod A has to be less than 1. So that's what this picture is showing us. This is the Z transform of the transfer function of the exponentially weighted moving average filter. And you can see we have a pole over here, we have a thing pushing us down over here. The pole, this guy here, is inside the unit circle. That's the red curve here is just showing the unit circle on the complex plane. The other thing it's showing you is how to work out what sort of filter this is. Is this going to be a low-pass or a high-pass filter? Well, we need to know the Fourier transform. We need to know the Fourier transform of this guy. The Fourier transform is just the values of this Z transform on this unit circle. So we look around the unit circle, and we see the Fourier transform. You notice that around here, the values are pretty low, but up here, they go up. This point here corresponds to zero frequency. So this will be a low-pass filter. It keeps these guys, the low frequencies, and attenuates the high frequencies. Anyone want to tell me how I could make this a better low-pass filter? How could I make it attenuate the high-pass signals more? I could put some zeros around here. I put a few zeros around here, that's going to push this whole bit of the sheet down, isn't it? Or I could take this pole and I could move it a bit closer here. That would make these values a bit higher. So relative to them, they'd be bigger. So a lot of filter design just comes down to pushing poles and zeros around in this complex plane to make this curve look the way you want it to look. Of course, you want to be careful about this because the number of poles and zeros, the number of zeros of a polynomial of degree p is p. So the more of these poles and zeros have, the higher degree polynomial these are, and that means the more computations I have to do in my filter. So you want to be sparing with the number of poles and zeros you put into this complex plane as well. Also, you don't want to be too finicky. You don't want to put this guy really close to this, because we always work with numerical precision. We have quantization errors. And those quantization errors can mean that even though in this beautiful picture I have here, this pole is inside the circle, when I make a quantization error, maybe it creeps outside the circle. And then suddenly I get feedback, I get a feedback loop which has gain, and then I get unstable output. Classic example of this is I take a microphone like this. How many people know what would happen if I took this up and put it next to the speaker? I get this loud squealing sound because I'm getting a feedback system with gain. We don't want that to happen typically.